Mildred's adversary was much bigger and much stronger than she was. Not as agile, though. And because he was so tall and his arms were so long, he was handicapped by the confined space of the kitchen. The low ceiling and narrow walls would make it difficult for him to aim and deliver full power blows. The angel came at her like a whirlwind. His blade tip knocked the iron pans off the walls and crashed through the collection of dishes and crockery. Mildred was unable to return a single thrust. Under the horrific attack, all she could do was retreat while keeping up her guard. They circled the cluttered little room again and again, the canny sword point scoring the ceiling and walls as he tried, forehand and back, to angle a killing strike through her defenses. The angel's repeated blows on her cutlass hilt sent shockwaves and pain rippling up her hand, arm, and shoulder. She realized it wouldn't be long before all three went numb, making it impossible to lift the cutlass, or maybe causing her to lose her grip on it altogether. It was a matter of physiology, not willpower or determination. As she ducked away from him, he nicked the back of her left hand with the edge of his blade. It was a sharp tug, then a stinging sensation. Mildred looked down to see the skin gone over the knuckle of her middle finger. For a second, she saw the exposed white bone, then the wound filled with blood.
Little bit of pieces.
Even though he'd cut her, Mildred knew she'd lucked out. She had come within an inch or two of losing all the fingers on that hand. She couldn't stay lucky for long. As she barely twisted out from under an overhead strike, she realized she was praying for a single chance, an opportunity to stick this pig while she still had the strength to run him through. In other words, it was desperation time. Dragging the sword point on the floor to rest her arm, she darted around the room's small work table.
Can't hold it up anymore?
The angel grabbed the tabletop in his left hand and tossed the thing aside. Mildred took her best shot. The canny's arms were wide apart, and he was momentarily rocked back on his heels. She whipped the blade point up and lunged. It was a trick, a sucker's game. The angel neatly turned to make her miss, and as he did, he slashed down with his sword. Again, Mildred felt the rasping tug of steel on flesh and a burst of sharp pain. This time, it was her sword arm that was struck. A long, oval patch of skin was sliced from her tricep. The pink flesh beneath oozed red. Hot blood poured down her arm and wrist. Inside the cutlass's basket, her fingers were suddenly slippery on the grip.
This is gonna be the death of a thousand cuts. You're no match for me.
Mildred had to agree with that. Her legs were fine, but it was getting hard to swing the sword. She was moving the blade slower and slower, and she could feel her arm getting weaker. She didn't stand a chance with this particular weapon, under these circumstances. When he charged her again, she managed to fend him off with the cutlass, but dodging was far preferable to parrying his powerful blows. As she skirted the perimeter of the room, she let the weapon drag again. She needed to recover the feeling in her sword hand before she tried Plan B. Mildred made a point of not glancing directly at the two revolvers stuffed into the front of the angel's pants. But she had already noted the way their butts and trigger guards hung tantalizingly over the waistband. Two very familiar weapons, both fully loaded when she last hefted them. She didn't want the canny to guess what she had in mind until it was too late for him to do anything about it.
I'd rather not die by inches. If you promise to chill me quick, I'll throw down the sword and give up.
The angel spread his arms in a transparently bogus gesture of magnanimity.
Sure, why not? Go ahead and drop it.
She held out her empty hands.
There. I lived up to my part of the bargain. It's your turn.
Though it made her scalp crawl, when the angel started to step up, she forced herself to slip to her knees in front of him and assumed the classic, doomed prisoner pose. She looked up, meeting his eyes and holding his gaze.
Make it quick now.
The canny's expression twisted into an evil leer as he cocked back the cutlass, fully intending to finish her off with a single terrible swipe.
God, bitch.
Well inside his guard in the cutting arc of his long blade, Mildred lunged up from the floor. The angel reacted just as she had expected. He jumped backward so he could bring his cutlass to bear. But he didn't move far enough, and certainly not fast enough. Reverse was his slowest speed. Mildred kept coming at him full tilt, driving with her legs, her arms outstretched toward his midsection. Before he could retreat farther or twist away from her hands, she grabbed the butts of both pistols at once. Mildred didn't yank the blasters free. That would have taken too long, and perhaps given the giant canny time to smash in the top of her head with his sword's pommel. She simply turned the weapon's barrels and cylinders, twisting them around inside his pants. She ground the sights and muzzles deep into his groin. The angel doubled over, clutching at his belly and his perforated bowels. He staggered backward a half step, then his knees buckled. No longer able to stand, he sat hard. His legs extended out straight from his hips, his heels drumming on the floor.
That pretty much evens the odds, doesn't it?
Mildred stowed the pistols in her belt and picked up the cutlass she had dropped. The gutshot angel gave her a look, squinty, hateful. It was supposed to be defiant to the last, like a wounded tiger. It came across more like a wounded jackal. She wiped her bloody hand on the back of her trousers, then delivered a backhand slash across the front of the canny's undefended throat that nearly took off his head. Cutlass in one hand, Python in the other, she returned to the ship's control room on the run. She fully expected to meet more angels head-on, either in the narrow corridor or in La Golondrina's suite, but there was none in sight. She was kind of disappointed. The smell of sandalwood incense still hung heavy and cloying in the Queen's chamber. Behind the drooping folds of brown muslin, backlit by the oil lamp's weak glow, a slender figure suddenly moved for the wheelhouse door.
Hold it right there!
Mildred hacked down the intervening gauze curtains. La Golondrina found herself caught in mid-step. She lowered her pale, scrawny arms to her sides.
There's been a slight change of menu. Soup's off.
I don't know how you managed to get away, but you have accomplished nothing. You have earned yourself a few more meaningless moments of life, that's all.
Maybe I can think of something to make them meaningful.
No matter what you do, you will still end up on my plate. Bonita sauce made from your own marrow, I think.
But will you be around to enjoy it?
La Golondrina scowled at her.
I think you know what's going to happen next.
The freezy hag filled her withered lungs and lifted her head to cry for help. In a blur, Mildred thrust the cutlass forward, stopping its keen point against the front of La Golondrina's throat. The blade neatly pricked the wrinkled parchment skin. Instead of screaming, the queen jumped back, clutching at her neck with a skeletal hand.
Shouting won't do you a bit of good. It sounds like your lackeys have problems of their own. No help is coming, at least not in time.
La Golondrina bent with a speed that took Mildred by surprise. Out from under a tasseled pillow, the queen pulled a long silver dagger. The first 2 inches of its needle point gleamed iridescently in the lamplight, making Mildred think it had been dipped in poison. Jabbing weakly with the slender knife, the canny queen began to circle her fellow Freezy. In that baggy black dress, she looked like a doll made of sticks, one leg long, one leg short.
Spicy!
Mildred swung down with the flat of her sword, knocking the dagger out of La Golondrina's hand.
You broke my wrist! Oh! You broke my wrist!
The queen cradled one bony hand with the other.
If you're looking for pity, you've got to know you're looking in the wrong place.
Mildred dropped the sword on the floor and shifted the .357 Magnum revolver to her strong hand, a gesture with unmistakable meaning under the circumstances.
You can't chill me. Not if you're really infected with oozies. I'm the only thing that can keep you alive. You need me in one piece with my immune system pumping up a storm.
Because your blood is the only cure?
That's right. I have enough antibodies in me to save 100,000 cannies from the Grey Death.
I'm not a canny yet.
But you will be soon enough. Nobody escapes the virus.
You're wrong about that. I think there is a way.
You're kidding yourself, my dear.
Maybe so, but it's worth a shot.
Mildred scooped up one of the plush pillows. With her left hand, she jammed it against the stunt woman's face. Not as a courtesy to the queen, rather to avoid coating Jack's favorite blaster with cranial backsplatter. Mildred leaned down, out of the line of fire, over the frail, twitching body. As she did so, she took a detailed inventory of her every sensation. Her right hand and wrist tingled from the Magnum revolver's powerful recoil. She smelled burned cordite and coppery blood mixed with sandalwood. She could feel a river of sweat sliding down the hollow of her back, between her buttocks. Her heart was beating like mad, but the unholy desire that Junior Thibodeau had tortured her with wasn't there.
Maybe I don't need to do anything more. Maybe the infection didn't take hold after all. Maybe I'm safe.
The scientist in her answered with cold, irrefutable logic. There was no way of knowing, one way or another, until the full array of behavioral and physiological symptoms showed up. In other words, until it was too late. The real question was whether she could live out the rest of her life with something so horrible hanging over her head. There was only one way to make sure she had nothing to fear. The irony of the situation wasn't lost on Mildred, but she knew exactly what she had to do, and she steeled herself for it. Mildred made her mind go blank before she started. She didn't let herself think. She didn't let herself breathe through her nose or mouth. She closed her eyes. She didn't let herself feel anything. She knew if she hesitated for a second, she could never go through with it. Before she was finished, the gunfire outside the wheelhouse ceased. There were more full auto bursts, scattered and erratic, but they came from the deck below. Then she heard someone coming her way. She hurried. Ryan burst into the wheelhouse, blaster in hand. He was a sight for sore eyes.
Mildred, are you...
He stopped in his tracks when he saw the blood dripping from her mouth and hands. Then he looked down at the shriveled old woman on the floor beneath her. The top of the woman's head was gone. Her skull plate and the attached hair had been tossed aside. The cranial vault had been emptied. It was a moment frozen in time. A moment that should have spanned an hour, but didn't.
Ryan!
Mildred, you know I always keep my promise.
Ryan's face twisted in sorrow. He pointed the Sig Sauer at her heart and tightened his finger on the trigger.
No, Ryan, don't!
A fraction of an ounce short of trigger break, Ryan caught himself. This wasn't an act he cared to perform in front of an audience, particularly an audience that included his lover. Ryan was certain that Mildred didn't want it done in front of the others either. That wasn't her style. He released the trigger and lowered his Sig Sauer. Doc and Sprue entered the wheelhouse behind the tall redhead. Doc looked as startled and concerned as she did.
Good grief, my dear Dr. Wyeth. What has happened? Are you injured? Have you been shot?
It's not her blood.
When the awful truth sank in, shock, anger, and betrayal replaced the concern on the companions' faces. Of the three companions, Doc the Victorian was without a doubt the most hurt and the most outraged.
Well, Dr. Wyeth?
Ryan's right. It isn't my blood.
Mildred picked up an embroidered pillow from the floor and wiped her hands and mouth on it. Tossing the cushion aside, she pointed at the supine, emaciated body.
It all came out of her. That was La Golondrina, the Canny Queen. I shot her dead with Jack's blaster.
The means by which the killing was accomplished is of no importance. I think I speak for everyone when I say that what you did after you shot her is our only concern.
It was the last thing I ever wanted to do. Believe me, I know what this looks like, but really... It isn't what you think.
Evidence to the contrary is smeared on that pillow and clotting under your fingernails. I understand why Ryan was prepared to immediately dispatch you to hell. I commend him for his initiative and second the motion.
She asked me to do it, Doc, right after she got dosed by that scar-faced Thibodeau. She said I was to put her down, no questions asked, if she ever showed any signs.
I think what we have before us constitutes more than a mere indication or a potentiality.
I haven't turned canny. What I mean is, I'm not the pawn of some infectious disease. I chose the act, consciously, rationally, in full possession of all my faculties. It was the only way I could think of to cure myself.
But you're not sick.
That's right. I don't have any concrete symptoms. I felt lousy for a while, but that seems to have passed. Nearly getting your head cut off tends to clear the mind. Maybe what I felt was the power of suggestion, Junior's suggestion. By all accounts, the disease should have kicked in by now, but it hasn't.
If you are not sick, pray tell, why did you subject yourself and your victim to this abomination?
Mildred, haven't you risked an even bigger chance of infection?
Not from La Golondrina. She could never infect anyone. After she came out of cryosleep, she no longer had the virus. She just had the antibodies to it, the virus killers her body manufactured. It seems logical to assume that if one drop of her blood can save 100 cannies from the Gray Death, a massive dose of her antibodies will keep an early-stage infection from ever taking hold. I wanted to make certain that I never got the oozies.
I concede that you were forced into the vile act against your will in the first instance. But this time it's different. You perpetrated the deed all on your own.
I had no choice.
All you are giving us is conjecture and speculation. What proof do we have that you are really cured of anything? All we have is your admission to what you have done. Perhaps you have already succumbed to the disease and don't realize it yourself.
Mildred indicated an opaque, pinkish residue on the floor beside the corpse.
That's where I puked it all up the first time. Ask yourself, Doc, if I had already turned canny, would I have thrown it up? Or would I have wolfed it down and be out looking for seconds?
I find that argument less than convincing. As we used to say in my day, a cannibal is as a cannibal does.
That's a catch-22, Doc.
I beg your pardon?
A no-win situation. You're saying a person is defined by his or her actions, ignoring his or her intent. By your yardstick, I became a canny the instant I was forced to swallow brains in that cave.
Doc reflected on that for a second, and as he did so, his anger seemed to abate. Then he looked chagrined.
Yes. Yes, I do see the problem. The logic is circular and absurd. An elementary confusion of case and class. Aristotle would be horrified. Please accept my sincerest apologies. I let emotion sway my reason. It was both unfair and unseemly.
No apology needed, Doc. It's like that old pre-dark joke. When I occasionally cook up some dinner, you don't call me Mildred the chef. When I happen to shoot a rabbit, you don't call me Mildred the rabbit killer. But just eat one little brain.
At least you've still got your sense of humor.
I never heard of a canny crack and a halfway decent joke.
Neither had anyone else.
You really ate the whole thing?
If a brain can make me sick, a brain can make me well. Sad to say.
Two brains in as many days. I sincerely hope you are not acquiring a taste for it.
If you knew how absolutely gross they were, you would never say that, my friend.
I believe I shall take your word for it, if you do not mind.
Christy indicated the body on the floor.
What are we going to do with the rest of her?
She has to be completely destroyed.
Let's check those lamps. See how much oil they've got left in them.
There was oil aplenty for a funeral pyre. The companions gathered and heaped all the cushions in the middle of the room and piled on the ripped-down gauze. Ryan and Sprue lifted the frail corpse by ankles and wrists and deposited it on top of the mound. Mildred bent and snatched up a hank of long black hair, to which part of the skull plate was still attached. She tossed it into La Golondrina's lap. Doc and Sprue poured the lamp oil over everything. Pillows, gauze, black baggy dress, anorexic form.
Our Cajun friends are waiting for our signal to start the attack on the main deck. This should do them just fine.
Ryan struck a wooden match on the back of his pants and tossed it onto the heap. The oil ignited. Brilliant blue flames licked around the queen's pallid form. They threw off tiny sparks as they leapt from the fine gauze to the saturated pillows. As the flames jumped higher, fed by cloth and flesh, they turned vivid orange. The fire quickly spread and grew in intensity. In seconds, the entire mound was ablaze, and the flames shot up to the gauze-draped ceiling. Behind the curtain of fire, the Freezy's parchment skin crackled as it blistered, peeled, and blackened. Her blood hissed as it turned to steam. The firelight danced in the reflection of the wheelhouse's windows. It flickered off the walls, casting wild shadows over the grisly ceremony. The signal was duly noted on the deck below.
They're pushing the cannies this way so they can trap them below decks. The ship's already set to explode. We want them inside when that happens.
Shouldn't we go down and help the Cajuns?
You guys go on ahead. I'll catch up. I'm not leaving until she's completely burned.
We'll all wait. The Cajuns are doing fine on their own. They don't need our help now. Getting the job done here is more important.
Besides, we don't want to get split up again. Not under these circumstances. We're sitting on a very big bomb that's about to go off.
As the ceiling's drooping fabric channels caught fire, the heat at the room's center became almost unbearable. The companions were forced back from the pyre, their hands clamped over their mouths and noses. A small measure of protection from the lung-scalding high temperature and the choking black smoke given off by the burning cushion foam. As the fight moved inexorably in their direction, they stood silent witness to La Golondrina's incineration. The baggy cocktail dress was long gone. The queen's blackened skin had withered to ash. Her internal organs had shriveled and charred. Her skeleton glowed red as air sucked in through the open door and broken windows fed the flames. Sweat rolling down their faces, Ryan and the others let her cook to a turn until there was not a single drop of her juices left, until the ligaments and sinews that held her bones together gave way, until her skeleton collapsed in on itself, throwing up a shower of bright sparks.
She's done. Let's go. I got the impression Chita Luis isn't going to wait for us to show up before he blows the ship. He's going to demolish it the first clear chance he gets, whether we're off it or not.
With Ryan in the lead, they left the wheelhouse. Outside, the air felt cool against their sweat-soaked clothes and skin. They stepped around the dead angels on the deck, retracing their route across the bridge wing to the staircase entrance. Ryan looked down from the top step, Sig Sauer in hand. There were four flights and two hallways between them and the break in the staircase just above the fourth floor. He couldn't see any farther than the next landing down, where the steps dogleg left. He couldn't see what was going on out on the deck either.
Hold at the first landing. I'll go down and check the door to the next hall.
As they began their single-file descent, they had a new problem, or rather an old problem exacerbated. With Mildred's additional weight, the staircase was under even more strain. It quaked and swayed. It was like walking on a suspension bridge or a tightrope.
Oh, shit, I'm a stick!
Sprue's legs were trembling, which wasn't helping the situation one bit.
Not so fast. Take your time.
When they stopped on the first landing, the shaking subsided. Ryan continued down the flight of stairs. As he was about to step off onto the landing, the hallway door opened inward. A big man in pigtails and chin beard looked up, very surprised to see him. So many questions, all with the same answer. The bullet impact sent the canny flying through the doorway in reverse. As the angel toppled onto his back, ragdoll limp, the spring-loaded door automatically swung shut. Ryan retreated up the stairs as the others descended, their weapons ready to back him up.
Don't fire! The bastards can't hit us from here. They don't have the angle.
Let them waste their ammo.
How many do you think are in there, Ryan?
Three, maybe four, if the blasters are anything to go by.
They're joining the party on deck a little late, don't you think?
Maybe they thought their pals had it under control. Plenty of numbers, plenty of blasters. No need to ruffle their skanky little braids. Doesn't look that way to them now.
If the bastards were heading down the steps to help their canny kin, you changed their minds in a hurry, Carter. They saw you blast that angel from above, maybe even heard us coming down. They'll be desperate to go the other way, to get up to the tower and see to their queen.
He's right. The angel's mission is to protect La Golondrina. They probably don't even know the wheelhouse is on fire. They can't see it from here. They're thinking about making a last-ditch stand. There's only one way up to the wheelhouse, and it's defendable.
You know they're gonna beat feet up the steps to check it out as soon as we're past.
And your point is?
The convoy master put a hand to the wall to brace himself and bobbed his weight on the staircase. All became clear.
Mr. Sprue would have us thwart their efforts by rendering the tower approach certain death.
Yeah, what he said.
We sure don't want to leave these guys with access to the tower windows. Don't want them pot-shotting at us while we cross the deck. But we don't have time to bust through the door and take the hallway room by room.
Sounds like Sprue has the best option.
The only option.
You're busy, big man.
Sprue started bouncing up and down, getting a good rhythm going. The entire staircase began to flex. The others fell into the swing of things, adding their weight to his efforts. The stairs up-flex levered the lag bolts from the walls. The down-flex did the same thing. In fractions of an inch, with the staircase creaking like rusty bed springs, the retaining bolts backed out of their holes. The risers and the treads separated.
Enough. Sprue, you and me will put up covering fire while the others slip past the door. Keep on going until you reach the fourth floor. Don't wait for us. Don't stop for anything.
The convoy master stepped carefully down beside Ryan and unlimbered both of his semi-auto blasters.
Ready.
Now.
Ryan gestured to Sprue as he descended the stairs, cutting down the firing angle. Sprue did the same. When they were shoulder to shoulder on the landing, they both opened fire on the door, pumping round after round through it and down the hallway beyond. If there were angels on the other side, they were either shot to pieces or ducking for cover. Behind them, the others slipped safely past. As Twisty, Doc, and Mildred raced down the steps full tilt, the weakened landing shuddered sickeningly under Ryan and Sprue. The Deathlands warrior grabbed hold of the big man's shoulders and pulled him away from the door.
Whoa!
They hurtled down the swaying stairs three at a time, hearing the lag bolts popping free. Below them, the gap in the staircase loomed. Below that was the fourth floor landing. To Sprue's great relief, jumping down proved a whole lot easier than had jumping up. In unison, the two men leapt from the stairs to the small grated platform. It buckled in the middle, but it held. Sprue shoved Ryan through the hallway's open door where the others waited. As he ducked in after, it all came down. Ryan didn't bother closing the door. It led nowhere. The companions were crouched on either side of the fourth floor hallway, weapons ready. At the other end of the corridor, Kenny stood in front of the windows with long blasters and armfuls of extra mags. A few looked over at the newcomers in alarm. Others were preoccupied with the job at hand, getting ready to rain down death on the deck. Ryan waved the others forward, intent on sweeping the hallway clean of hostiles. They had run only 40 feet or so when really big bangs from directly below jolted the entire superstructure. The floor jumped so violently under them that they either fell to their knees or were slammed into the walls. Dust cascaded from the ceiling and rose from the floor. The attention of all the would-be snipers immediately turned to the battle on the deck and the threat it posed them. They knelt in front of the glassless windows and shouldered their AKs. Ryan dashed ahead, closing the distance to the first shooter. He didn't realize it was the horse-faced woman until he was almost on top of her, and she half turned his way. She smiled at him, then squinted back down her rifle's sights. She still thought he was a canny.
Get yourself a blaster! From up here, it's a fucking turkey shoot!
There were several AK-47s on the floor at her side, along with a pile of loaded magazines. Ryan picked up one of the assault rifles. He checked the chamber for a live round, stepped between her and the cannies down the hall, and shot her once in the head. With all the firing going on, the other bastards didn't even notice. The companions gathered up the other blasters and mags. Fanning out, they turned the appropriated weapons on the canny shooters, peeling them away from the windows with hot lead. Only the two snipers at the far end of the corridor managed to pull back and return fire. With high-powered slugs streaking past, Sprue grabbed Doc by the waist and carried him through an open doorway on the left. Over the clatter of blaster fire, Ryan heard the sound of a rocket approaching. He launched himself into Christy and Mildred, knocking them to the deck, shielding them with his body. Gathering themselves, Ryan and the companions charged through the smoke to the door that led to the only stairway down. They had three floors and six more flights to go. Everything went smoothly until they passed the second floor, when they heard the sound of many boots, then felt the vibration. The staircase shook and groaned.
The bastards are on the steps, coming this way, retreating from the main deck.
If he was correct, Ryan knew the cannies were forewarned. They had already seen the flame shooting from the wheelhouse. They knew trouble was above them. They would be advancing with weapons up, ready to shoot anything that moved. Ryan took another AK from Mildred, dropped both weapon selector switches to full auto. An assault rifle in either hand, he charged down the stairs to meet the canny wave head on. Ryan knew that fighting downhill was a lot easier than fighting up. He didn't have to take his eye off his targets to keep from tripping. He was already looking down. The oncoming canny wave broke over an immovable object. Firing from the hip, Ryan stitched bullets through their heads and shoulders, sweeping them aside. He riddled their backs as they turned to run the other way. Some of them jumped the rail to keep from being shot. The companions clambered over the shambles of heaped bodies. They ignored the wounded. Even if mercy had occurred to them, there was no time for coup de grace. As Ryan reached the main deck, he saw smoke boiling up from the stairwell that led to the next level down. The steps were black, twisted ruins. Cannies could still climb them, but with difficulty. Ryan hurried the others into the open, into the lee of the bridge tower. Blaster fire echoed from the second and third floors above. The Cannies assembled there weren't shooting at them, but at something, or someone, farther off on the island. The deck in front of them was littered with bodies and parts of bodies, and scorched with 30-foot-wide blast rings. Nothing moved.
Where is everybody?
Nobody had an answer to that.
Time to leave. They still think we're Cannies. They won't shoot their own kind.
The companions crossed the deck at a measured pace. Not panicked, but focused. As though they had business to attend to. At the head of the ramp, they looked out at the desolate marshland.
I can't see anyone.
Look, out on the path. See? Way off in the distance? Someone's waving.
Damn. They sure are far away.
I don't like the look of this.
As rifle fire from the ship's tower continued to fall on the path, the Cajuns and former Kenny prisoners took to their heels, trying to get out of range. Some made it, some didn't. Those who didn't dropped in mid-stride, either thrashing in pain or silent and still in death. Slugs smacked the salty puddles and flicked the blades of marsh grass. A sparse, leaden rain, whizzing to earth.
Face it, your friends are all chilled. There's only one way on and off that ship. There's only one path leading to it, and you're looking at it. There's no other place for them to go. If they aren't here with us, they're goners. And you're about to join them. A lot of brave fighters gave up their lives tonight, and a lot more gonna die if you don't shoot.
JB said nothing in response. He continued to scan the side of the distant ship, but with failing hope.
Either fire that rocket, or hand it over. If you don't, I'm going to blow your head off.
JB reached up and shoved the M16's flash hider away from his face.
You want the heat? You got it, Chief.
As JB lurched to his feet, he jammed the pointed nose of the warhead into Cheetah Luis's flat stomach. His finger rested on the launcher's trigger, ready to rock. The Cajun looked down at him and shook his head.
You don't have the balls, little fella.
Got any last words?
If you fire, you die too.
In case you're interested, mine or fuck you. Look, they coming!
Jack's sharp eyes had picked up movement at the top of the freighter ramp. In the light of the main deck's oil drum fires, JB could make out Christie's red hair and Mildred's dusky skin. He couldn't identify with certainty the two tall men with them, but he figured they had to be Ryan and Doc. Sprue, the fat man, was unmistakable, even at 600 yards.
You are one lucky crawdad-eating son of a bitch.
No luckier than you are.
Jack grabbed a torch from one of the fighters and started waving it overhead to get the companions' attention. It worked. The five of them came barreling down the dirt ramp. For a short distance after they reached ground level, their backs were protected by the height of the ship's hull. The shooters in the tower couldn't see them below it. But as soon as they appeared on the path, heading at an all-out sprint to join the retreating attackers, the Cannies figured whose side they were really on. Blaster fire chattered from the second and third floors of the tower. No longer aimed at the Cajuns and former captives, but at the companions. JB knew the Cannies had the wrong weapons for the job. He had seen the limits of their arsenal, and there wasn't a real sniper rifle in the lot. What they had was raw firepower. Great for shooting ducks in a barrel. Great for human wave assaults. Piss poor for hitting scattered running targets. The raw firepower quotient took an upward jump as more and more Cannies appeared on the deck, lining the rail with their assault rifles. It was clear to JB that his side had hardly made a dent in their numbers. This while suffering high losses, particularly among the skilled Cajun fighters. JB was sure he could see somebody storming around on the deck, no doubt whipping up and organizing the pursuit. It felt as though everything was about to fall apart.
They're coming down the ramp, dammit!
Indeed, the Cannies abandoned ship in hordes, chasing after the fleeing quintet. The bastards who remained along the rail and in the tower continued to fire at the companions' backs. JB and Jack could do nothing to aid their comrades. They knew firing on the pursuit was a waste of ammo. They couldn't hope to hit running Cannies with assault rifles at 600 yards. The Cajuns didn't share that pessimism. Several opened up with their long blasters.
Dark Knight, no! Don't shoot! From this angle, you're just as likely to hit my friends!
Behind them, the escapees had taken advantage of the targeting shift. They were already 200 yards farther away, and well beyond the accurate range of the tower guns. JB knew the Cannies couldn't have cared less. They planned to run down the captives long before they reached the other side of the island. under a torrent of blaster fire from the ship. Ryan and the others duck between the cargo container's smokers.
They're clear now! Fire the fucking thing! They're still too close to the ship. The shockwave would chill them.
Ryan had to have realized that as well, because after a few seconds, he and the others burst from cover, dashing along the path, trying to put more distance between themselves, the freighter, and the pursuit. There was another thing that JB was sure had registered in his old friend's mind. The farther they got from the ship's burning oil drums, the less light there was for the cannies to shoot by. It was bright enough looking back at the vessel, but looking away from it, it was like looking down a deep, dark well. JB knew it was coming up on crunch time. The companions were about 300 yards away. The cannies trailing them were about 150 yards beyond that, and closing rapidly. If he and Jack waited until the companions got completely clear of the blast zone, it was going to be too late. The cannies coming up behind would have already shot them in the back.
Get set, Jack.
Jack shouldered his launcher.
Uh-huh.
And peered through the sight.
Shit! About fucking time. Gasoline is in a hold on the first deck just forward amidships, Jack. It's on our side of the ship.
Got it.
Clear behind!
JB acquired the target and adjusted his aim for the distance. The bullseye was big, but it was a half mile off. The twin tracks of the exhausts glowed orange as they streaked over the marsh, arcing up to the maximum height of their trajectory, then dropping down the last 30 yards. They made what seemed like pipsqueak flashes against the freighter's steel skin. The primary-shaped charges had exploded on impact, boring holes for the secondaries to slip through. A fraction of a second later, the bigger payloads detonated, blasting huge rips in the side of the vessel. That was it. No subsequent explosions. No chain reaction. They hurriedly reloaded their launchers.
Try a little more to the left.
Again, JB followed the glowing embers of the tailpipes as the warheads closed on their target. Both warheads detonated, tearing holes in the hull sheathing. Again, no cigar.
I thought you knew what you were doing.
I do.
The armorer sighted again. Jack had his reloaded launcher up, but he never got the shot off. The fifth burning ember was the charm. JB scored a 10-ring hit on the hold with the gasoline, which was right next to the armory with the RDX. Both were above the 10,000-gallon oil bunker. The explosion was much, much bigger than JB had expected. In a split second, the vast ship became a dome of light from one end to the other. A light so bright, it seemed to turn the steel translucent. The sides of the vessel peeled open under the awesome pressure. The deck and superstructure were launched upward in billions of fragments. The blast's concussion sent a 100-foot-high wave of dust rolling outward, a donut of churning black, propelled by a 1,000-mile-an-hour tailwind. JB watched in astonishment as the pursuing cannies were engulfed by the racing cloud. An instant later, astonishment turned to horror as the companions were swallowed up too. Ryan, Christy, Mildred, Doc, and Sprue vanished. Even though JB could see it coming right at them, he wasn't prepared for what happened next. The shockwave of the blast hit him like a battering ram. For a moment, he blacked out. When he came to, he found himself 20 feet up the path, flat on his rear end. If he had underestimated the power of the blast, he had also underestimated the diameter of the blast zone. Parts of the freighter began to fall all around them. Sections of steel railing, hunks of 3-inch-wide wire rope, anchor chain links, 8-inch rivets, other items too. Unidentifiable things, but definitely on fire. All of it thudded to earth. Junkyard hail. A mooring cleat landed on a Cajun standing right next to Jack. The cleat weighed 300 pounds if it weighed an ounce. It crushed the poor bastard like a grape. JB and the albino did the only thing they could. They ran like hell. When the deluge finally ended and the dust began to settle, a pall of noxious black smoke started to pour from the burning oil bunker. It spread like the densest fog over the landscape, obscuring everything, even the roaring blaze that spawned it. JB and Jack didn't speculate on the odds of finding their friends alive. They didn't speculate on anything. Without a word, they pulled rag masks over their noses and mouths, and after borrowing a couple of torches from the Cajuns, they moved back down the path in search of their companions. The torchlights barely penetrated the thick smoke. To view the ground, they had to hold the crackling flame a yard away. They followed the trail by feel and by stepping on things. When they stepped in water, they knew they were veering off the path. They found other things by feel and by stepping on them. Human body parts were mixed in with the scrap iron and steel, the remains of cannies from the freighter's main deck, blown 400 yards from the epicenter of the explosion.
You see anything, Jack?
Nope.
They both dreaded the prospect of finding their friends in pieces, but they had to look. On either side of the path were thousands of small, scattered fires from objects hurled far out onto the marsh. They cast a ghastly, wavering light through the curtain of smoke. As they proceeded to search, minor explosions popped off from the direction of the ravaged ship. JB and Jack couldn't see the vessel itself, but the yellow glow of its blaze reflected dully off the banks of low-hanging clouds. They found their friends 300 yards down the path, roughly where JB had seen the dust wave overtake them. They found Christy Roth first. She was face down, unbloodied but still. She looked dead. JB gripped her by the shoulder and gently turned her over. Then he leaned down and held the torch close to her face. As its heat radiated against her skin, the long strands of her prehensile, muddy hair coiled into tight ringlets of alarm.
She's alive, Jack.
Mills is over here.
JB shook Christy back to consciousness and got her to sit up.
Oh, my head.
You're gonna be all right. Just stay still for a minute. Get your bearings.
When he moved to check on Mildred, he found her already recovered and kneeling beside Ryan. Even with a filtering bag, it was difficult to breathe through the smoke.
Is he okay?
Don't know yet.
Mildred quickly checked Ryan for broken bones and flash burns, and found no serious injuries.
Jack's still looking for Doc and Sprue. They could be in much worse shape. We better help him.
About 20 feet away, Jack was standing over the seated old man and Sprue. Even in the weak torchlight, JB could see their hands and faces were coated with soot. He guessed the shockwave had to have landed them on their backs.
It's smoke inhalation. Get them on their feet. Get them moving.
As they did so, Mildred took the Colt Python from her belt and handed it to Jack.
You've probably been missing this.
He reholstered his weapon without thanking her. Miraculously, no one had been hit by falling debris. Aside from the smoke they'd breathed in, their injuries amounted to little more than contusions to the hands and face. They all regrouped around Ryan and Christy.
What about the cannies?
Ryan glanced back in the direction of the freighter. If there was anything moving closer to the ship, they couldn't see it for the smoke. There were no sounds of life either. No moans, no cries for help. Just the roar of the bunker oil burning out of control. The burning ship had managed to wreathe the entire island in smoke.
They were a lot closer to ground zero than you were. Shockwave probably blew them apart.
A lot of gator food round here, then.
Got to get you some fresh air, Doc.
Good luck finding some.
How are we going to get off this hellhole?
Same way we got on. Cheetah Luis sent some of his fighters ahead to capture the barge.
Let's get on with it before Doc drops dead.
They crossed the flat, featureless island like penitents, shuffling along the path, filthy, bloody, faces wrapped to the eyes in rags, bone-weary from the exertions of the last 2 days. After what seemed like hours of trudging, they sighted a row of dim lights through the smoke ahead. Then they heard the water lapping at the shore. The barge emerged out of the shifting smoke, torches lining its deck. There were few people aboard, the sole survivors. As the companion stepped aboard, the Cajuns were dumping the dead canny skipper and crew over the side. Cheetah Louise greeted them.
You were the last ones to make it out.
Looks like it.
Mighty expensive victory.
The Cajun looked around the boat. Cheetah Louise had lost 2/3 of his kinsmen fighters in the battle and subsequent explosion. Some of the freed prisoners looked shell-shocked. They couldn't believe what they had lived through. Some openly wept, their faces buried in their hands, mourning the loss of loved ones.
Way better than an expensive defeat.
Back home, we still got a fight on our hands. Got to hunt down the rest of the bastards before we can start fixing things the way they used to be. Gonna be a long, hard road.
You'll find your way.
The barge backed out of the narrow cove, piloted by one of the Cajuns. He steered it over the black water toward the mainland, leaving the foul stench of burning oil behind. With the clean salt air rushing over them, the companions stripped off their rag masks. Mildred took a seat beside Ryan on the bow. To the east, dawn was breaking a bloody red. Canny red.
We didn't get all of them.
Got a lot, though. Put a serious dent in them.
How long before the cure wears off and the bastards start to die back?
No way to predict that, Ryan. The important thing is they won't spread any further.
Couldn't there be other cure carriers like Gullandrina out there? The whole thing could start all over again.
Anything is possible. We don't know what caused her to be the source of cure in the first place. We don't know how she became a canny either. Even she didn't know that.
How much of her is inside you?
You're thinking I might be carrying the cure?
It crossed my mind.
Ryan, just because I harvested her antibodies doesn't mean I have the capacity to store them or to make them for myself. The cure La Gullandrina produced was the result of a complex set of unique biochemical processes. The genetic changes behind those processes were created by a series of events that cannot be reconstructed, even if we knew what they were.
So, you're saying it's over?
I'm saying it's over for now. Enjoy the sunrise.
Deathlands Cannibal Moon is a Graphic Audio production. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Copyright 2007, James Axler. Performed by Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Nanette Savard, Dylan Lynch, Tim Carlin, David Coyne, James Lewis, Kate Torrey, Thomas Penny, James Konacek, Bruce Rauscher, Michael Raplogel, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Rick Rowan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Vocal editing by Carlos Anderson. Graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton and Christian Parent. The Deathlands theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Additional original music by Brian Patton, Chris Rowan, Matt Webb, Dan Smith, and Johann Detweiler. Novel adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Ferrier. If you enjoy Deathlands, be sure to look for James Axler's Outlanders, available at road stops everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.